transmitted live to Middle East Technical University, we must ask you to refrain from electronic communication, including internet, throughout the event. Thank you for your understanding. I would like to welcome you all to the 7th Frantic Memorial Lecture on Freedom of Expression and Human Rights. Boğaziçi University began these lectures in 2008 to commemorate Hrant Dink, who spent his life promoting human dignity and freedom in this country. The conferences began as an initiative of a diverse group of Boğaziçi faculty in the immediate aftermath of Hrant Dink's assassination. It continues with the support of the Office of the Rector under the joint responsibility of the Departments of History, Sociology, and Political Science and International Relations. The organizing committee of this year's lecture would like to thank İlgi İletişim for providing the simultaneous translation equipment and our Department of Translation Studies for simultaneous translation of the lecture into Turkish. Thanks are also due to Dipnot İletişim for their help with the publicity of the event. As always, we would like to thank our rector, Gülay Barbarosoğlu, for her support. Now I would like to invite her here to deliver her opening remarks.
Değerli meslektaşlarım, çok kıymetli misafirler, sevgili öğrenciler. Tam 7 yıl oldu, ne oldu? Hrant Dink 7 yıl önce, 19 Ocak 2007'de öldürüldüğünde, Boğaziçi Üniversitesi'nde bir dizi Karanlığa Ses Veriyoruz etkinliği gerçekleştirilmişti. Bu etkinlikleri düzenleyen arkadaşlarımız, cinayetten bir sene sonra Hrant'ı, hayatına adadığı iki kavramla birlikte anan bir etkinlik daha hazırladılar. Hrant Dink anısına İfade Özgürlüğü ve İnsan Hakları Konferansı. Bugün bu konferansın 7.'si için bir araya gelmiş bulunmaktayız. Hrant Dink'in faillerinin bulunması, bu cinayetin arkasındaki kirli işler ağının ortaya çıkarılması, bu tür acıları bir daha yaşamamak için adaleti yerine getirmesi adına İlk kez 2008'de düzenlenen konferansın konuşmacısı olan Arundhati Roy ile beraber sormuştuk. Bir yıl geçti. Ne oldu, ne değişti? 2009'da Bingman ile beraber sormuştuk. İki yıl oldu, ne oldu? 2010'da Klein ile beraber sormuştuk. Üç yıl oldu, ne oldu? 2011'de Cashman ile beraber sormuştuk. 4 yıl oldu, ne oldu? 2012'de Almakta ile beraber sormuştuk. 5 yıl oldu, ne oldu? 2013'te Chomsky ile beraber sormuştuk. 6 yıl oldu, ne oldu, ne değişti diye. Ne oldu sorusunun cevabını Hrant'ın bütün dostları aslında uzun zamandır biliyor. Bu cinayetin nasıl hazırlandığı, nasıl uygulandığı ve adaletin önünün nasıl tıkandığı konusunda çok ciddi işaretler ve bilgiler mevcuttur. Buna rağmen maalesef adaleti yerine getirmesi konusunda neyin değiştiği, neyin olduğu sorusuna cevabımız bu senede olumsuz. Ve bu durumdan da Hrant'ın avukatı ve arkadaşı Sayın Fethiye Çetin'in kitabının adına gönderme yaparak söyleyeyim, utanç duyuyoruz. Bu soruların cevapların hakkıyla verilmesi, benzer yasların, acıların ve utançların yaşanmaması için çok ama çok önemlidir. Umuyoruz ki bu sene ne değişti, ne oldu sorusuna olumsuz cevap verdiğimiz son sene olur. Aksi takdirde biz bu soruları bıkmadan usanmadan, karanlığın faillerine ayna tutuluncaya, suretleriyle karşılaşmaları sağlanıncaya, adalet yerini buluncaya kadar sormaya devam edeceğiz. Her sene olduğu gibi bu senede Konferans Organizasyon Komitesi'ndeki değerli arkadaşlarım büyük bir özveri ve titizlikle çalıştım. Kendilerine üniversitem adına tek tek şükranlarımı sunuyorum. Sözlerimi tamamlarken, başta 7. Hrant Dink anısı ifade özgürlüğü ve insan hakları konferansı verecek olan değerli konuğumuz Profesör Loic Akkan olmak üzere siz kıymetli Hrant Dink dostlarına bugün burada bizimle beraber olduğunuz, hakikate ulaşma çabasına katıldığınız ve ne değişti, ne oldu sorusunu bir kez daha sormamızı sağladığınız için teşekkür ediyor, sevgi ve saygılarımı sunuyorum.
Understanding dynamics of resistance and opposition has been a significant problem for social science and humanities, and the problem has become urgent during the past few years. Grounded in theories that have traditionally sought to trace the ability to resist large-scale structures of power, first in the working class and then in the bodies of women and racial and ethnic and sexual minorities, we found ourselves underprepared to deal with a new wave of dissent whose most striking feature appears to be its location, the city. This past summer, this state of affairs was brought home to us, scholars of Turkey, in the form of the now famous Gezi Park events. We watched in a curious mix of apprehension, excitement, and wonder as a tiny bit of green space became the occasion for a countrywide revolt that resonated with similar outbursts in New York, Tunis, Cairo, Barcelona, Sofia, and Rio. Do these seemingly disparate urban uprisings have something in common? And if they do, what might they be? How frequent can we expect such outbursts to be? Can a new democratic politics emerge from them? And if it can, what, if anything, can we scholars do to contribute to that new democratic politics? It is with these questions in mind that this year's organizing committee decided to invite Loic Bakan to deliver the lecture. Loic Bakan is professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and researcher at the European Center of Sociology in Paris. His research focuses on comparative urban inequality, ethno-racial domination, and the penal state. In his many books and articles, he has extended the sociological insights of the late Pierre Bourdieu to urban issues around the world. His books include Urban Outcasts, A Comparative Sociology of Advanced Marginality, Punishing the Poor, the Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity, and Deadly Symbiosis, Race, and the Rise of the Penal State. His lecture today is entitled Inequality, Marginality, and Social Justice in the City. Professor Bakan, thank you for accepting our invitation and coming here today in support of Hrant Dink's legacy. Stage is yours.
First of all, I want to thank the Hrant Dink Foundation and Boğaziçi University for this invitation to deliver the Hrant Dink Memorial Lecture on freedom of expression and human rights. It's an honor and it's a pleasure to come to Istanbul for the second time. I was here at this very university 7 years after my first visit. I had the chance to stay in this very Kennedy Lodge, and to have stayed at the top of the building, which has the most beautiful bathroom in the world. Because you have a simple window, it's a simple bathroom with a simple window, but you have a view of the Bosphorus. And so it was one of the reasons for accepting this invitation. But more seriously, it's the theme and the ideas to which this memorial lecture is dedicated. It's special to speak on this occasion because intellectuals are professionals in free speech. And they must not forget that free speech is a conquest. It's something that has to be acquired in struggle and that has to be defended. And it's something, it's a prize for which people have struggled and for which people have given their lives. And this particular event is for us an occasion to remember this and to pay our respects to those who have struggled for us to have the right to come to this lectern and to speak. And so the Ramdin Foundation, as you know, is devoted to fostering dialogue, empathy, and peace, to promoting equal opportunity for the next generation and the recognition of cultural diversity, and the taming of chauvinism and racism in the writing of history. Now, all of these things remarkably arise in the city. The city is the place and the web of institutions where all of these goals can at once be imagined, can be accomplished, but can also be threatened. In fact, you can only threaten something where it can arise. And so by definition, the city is both a place for an opportunity and for a threat to this opportunity. And you will note that I mentioned the city as a place and as a web of institution. With this duality, I am referring to the city as Urbs and the city as Civitas. Urbs and Civitas is a distinction introduced by the ancient historian Fustel de Coulanges in his classic book, The Ancient City, in which he points out the city is at once a place of assembly, of dwelling, of worship, but also of discussion. And it's also Civitas. It's a particular web of association, a particular set of institutions, including forms of political association that allow and nurture open civic discussion. And so I thought when I was invited to give this lecture, I thought I have to center on the city, and on the city as the place where free speech will emerge, will also be threatened. And then it made me think of what it is that characterizes the urban as this special milieu. There are several traditions that have defined what is distinctive about the city. There is a German school, in particular in the writings of the great historian and legal scholar and sociologist Max Weber. Max Weber characterizes the city, particularly the Western early modern city, as the combination of a marketplace and an autonomous political administrative entity. And the combination of these two, when they come together, creates a unique space of freedom. He makes a reference to the German expression, Stadt Luft macht frei, the air of the city makes you free, because as you come into the city, you leave behind your tutelage and the relationship of bondage to a lord and to a local community, and you enter into a space where you will become an equal to the other residents of the city, to the other citizens. The city is the place where citizenship as an institution was invented. There's also the work of Georg Simmel, who wrote about the city as a place of anonymity, a place also, he had a somewhat negative vision of the city, as a place where also we become, our senses become overloaded, and we develop an aversive relationship to one another. But he pointed out that anonymity is the condition for the diversification of experiences, of roles, of aspirations. And this becomes transformed into the second school that has looked at what characterizes the city, the Chicago School of Urban Sociology of the early 20th century, in particular the work of Robert Park, Ernest Burgess, and Louis Wirth, who characterize the city by three characteristics: a high volume of population, a high density of population, and a high ethnic or cultural heterogeneity that creates a unique environment where you have subcultural differentiation. And subcultural differentiation gives to people of various origins, of various cultural, religious, ethnic visions, the ability to develop their own way of life. So the city is this unique place for cultural diversity. And lastly, you have the Marxist approaches to the city. In particular, the neo-Marxist works of the 1970s, where somebody like David Harvey looks at the city as the place of the secondary circuit of accumulation of capital, the development of real estate that allows to resolve the contradictions of industrial capitalism. You have the work of my colleague from Berkeley, the early Manuel Castells, who looks at the city as a place of collective consumption. And so they see the city as a place which fuels conflict. Conflict over accumulation, conflict over space. So from these different traditions, we learn the city is a place of potential freedom, is a place of cultural differentiation, is a place of conflict. But I'm going to bring these approaches in my own way of thinking, but I will add another, and I will develop another. With my teacher and friend, the late Pierre Bourdieu, I propose to draw on these traditions, but to see the city as the site where we observe the accumulation, the differentiation, and the elaboration of various forms of capital. Economic capital, cultural capital, symbolic capital. Where is the place where these capitals become amassed, becomes the volume increases, but they become clearly different from one another. And because they become different from one another, there arises a rivalry between them, a battle between economic capital and cultural capital and symbolic capital. The city is this place. And I would, if I had to make a remark to the related to the recent urban protest around the Gezi Park. In Gezi Park, as we saw a particular fraction of the Istanbul population, the new cultural bourgeoisie of intellectuals and urban professionals and the urban middle class rising to assert the rights of cultural capital against an incipient alliance between economic capital, commercial interests, and political capital, the state deciding that we will transform this park into a mall, and the state will use its authority to allow economic capital to transform the use of the space of the city. And we see bearers of cultural capital, the new cultural bourgeoisie of the city, rising and in a sense protesting this and wanting to propose a different use of the construction of the city. I think this is a good illustration of how I want to approach the city as this site where economic, cultural, and symbolic capital become elaborated and enter into a rivalry. But now, let me then link this to the previous lectures. In the previous lectures, I must hasten to add that, the previous lectures, I have great admiration for the previous lectures. And I would have come to attend their lectures. I'm not sure I would come to attend one of my own lectures. Meaning, I feel very honored not only to give this lecture, but to give this lecture following in the footsteps of the previous lectures. But I'm going to take a different approach, which is, in their speeches to you, they looked directly at protest, at resistance, at, in a sense, political voice. I'm going to take a different perspective, is that I'm going to ask, why is it that we see so little protest? Why is it that political voice is so rarely heard? Why is it that resistance only occurs in these events like the Gezi protests, and then, in a sense, quote, things return to normal? In a sense, I'm going to ask the question that they didn't ask, which is, why is there so little pushback to political and economic capital? Why is cultural capital still so weak? And in particular, I'm going to ask, why is there so little resistance to urban polarization and the rise of urban inequality? And I'm going to bring, in a sense, my analytic apparatus to bear on the experience of those who have no capital, Those who are deprived of economic capital, but also deprived of cultural capital. The new urban poor, the urban poor that have emerged in the new structures of urban marginality in the last three decades in the large cities around the world. I'm going to look at the change in the structures and the experience of poverty at the bottom of society that I'm going to argue have disarmed the urban proletariat, have disarmed the urban poor, and have made them, in a sense, bystanders to the game of politics. You know, in a sense, bystanders to the Gezi protest, where we didn't see an alliance between the popular classes, the working classes, and the cultural bourgeoisie. And so I'm gonna take this view from below, in a sense, for a reason. In every epoch of rapid transformation in capitalist society, the urban poor have played the role of revelator, of collective malaise, and as catalyst for innovations in social inquiry, innovations in class control, and innovations in state action. If you go back to the 19th century, you will find that the amassing of the so-called dangerous classes in the belly of Restoration Paris around 1848, the threat of casual labor in Victorian London in the 1860s, the rise of, quote, mobile aggregations of impecunious immigrants in the 1890s in Chicago, all gave rise to new modes of social investigations and social intervention in the city. In a chapter entitled City of Dread, the great urban planner Peter Hall notes that modern city planning itself arose in reaction to the movement and the fear of the new poor in the city. He writes, modern urban planning, urban sociology, social policy arose, to quote, from the complex emotional reaction, part pity, part terror, part loathing, of the urban and upper classes to changing forms of urban disparity and dispossession around them. Now, what is distinctive in the last fin de siècle, in the turn of the late 20th century, early 21st century, now, this fin de siècle is not an exception. Over the past decade, the resurgence and the persistence of poverty, social destitution, ethno-racial conflict, street crime, public violence, their accumulation in distressed areas of the metropolis have moved to the front line of policy and scholarly debate again. On both sides of the Atlantic, in the United States, in Western Europe, state managers, policy experts, activists left have grown preoccupied with preventing and containing the urban disorders of the new poverty, brewing in particular within and around expanding territories of urban decline and dereliction. And in my book, Urban Outcast, I try to understand the return of this new urban question, of the new urban marginality. And I'm going to argue that one of the reasons why we see so little protest, why, you know, in a sense, the dual city has emerged, and the protesters are the new cultural bourgeoisie and not the urban poor, is because the new structures of urban marginality have disarmed the poor. The new structures of urban marginality, I'm going to argue, are characterized by two powerful forces. One material force, the rise of social insecurity, the normalization of social insecurity as the normal horizon of life for the post-industrial proletariat. And the second force is a symbolic force. It is the territorial stigmatization of the poor, which has created the weight of a sense of indignity. It's the symbolic weight that the new urban poor carry, which has fragmented them and disarmed them, rendered them, in a sense, incapable of constituting themselves into a political bloc and a political force, acting as such as an agent on the political scene, leaving the scene, in a sense, for the cultural bourgeoisie to become the potential force of resistance to the new alliance between economic and political capital. And I would argue this is, in a sense, what distinguishes our century from the 19th, from the long, what I call the long 40th Keynesian century of 1880 to 1980. For a century, in a sense, the working class was the force of protest, was the force that could resist an alliance between economic and political capital. And today it is the bearers of cultural capital, the new cultural bourgeoisie, as we saw in Gezi Park, but it leaves, in a sense, to the side of the political game, the new urban poor that no longer have a voice, that no longer have a way of expressing their wishes on the political scene. And the people who demonstrated in Gezi Park must be aware of this. I say we, because I would have been here demonstrating if I had been there. I am a member of the cultural bourgeoisie. In Paris, I live right next to one of the most beautiful parks of Paris, the Luxembourg Park. If somebody tried to touch the Luxembourg Park, I would be the first one to demonstrate and to want to protect this space. I would want to protect it as a space, as a public space, but I have to ask, who is the public going to the Luxembourg Garden? It's 90% of the users of the Luxembourg Park are middle class, educated middle class residents who see the park as one of their elements of their urban way of life. So if I defend the Luxembourg Garden, or if you defend Gezi Park against the encroachment of commercialism, or against the brutality of the state when the state reacted to the demonstrations to protect Gezi Park, you must always be aware that you are defending against an encroachment, but you're also protecting a class-based vision of the city that simultaneously opens the park, but also closes it to other potential users, and particularly closes the park or limits the effective use of the park to a particular sub-segment of the urban society. It's not the universal opening is formal, but the reality is the use of the park for the middle class. Just like museums, when museums become free, they are formally open to everybody. But who goes to museums? You must have cultural capital to even have the idea of going into a museum. So they are free, but in fact they are silently reserved to the bearers of cultural capital. And so we must be aware of the fact that the new wave of urban protests, such as Gezi Park, have both a democratic element of fighting the encroachment of political and economic capital, but they have also an exclusionary moment where they are really the demands and the rise of these cultural bourgeoisie that excludes those who don't have cultural capital. Who are they? They are the new urban outcasts. They are the new urban outcasts described in my book by that title, Urban Outcast. And I'm gonna essentially center on this book and give you a sense of the argument and how it helps us understand why the working class, why the post-industrial proletariat, or what I call the precarious fractions of the post-industrial precariat, of proletariat, you compress precarious proletariat, it gives you the neologism, precariat. Those fractions of the post-industrial working class whose life is determined by insecure, part-time, unstable, short-term work. Those are essentially being disabled from becoming full citizens in the city. And this is essentially what I'm going to argue. And the reasons why we don't see a protest such as Gezi Park, in a sense, ballooning and leading to potentially an urban revolution, is because we don't see an alliance between the cultural petty bourgeoisie and the precariat. But to understand why we don't see an alliance, we have to first realize that the precariat is there. And we have to understand what are the forces that are, in a sense, making the precariat this, in a sense, passive force that could be harnessed but isn't. So this is what I'm going to focus on. So in Urban Outcast, I summarize a decade of theoretical and empirical research in which I track the causes, the forms and the consequences of urban polarization, but looked at from below, from the standpoint of those who are deprived of both economic and cultural capital. And I provide a diagnosis of the rise and the predicament of the post-industrial proletariat that has coalesced in the neighborhood of relegation of the advanced societies. And In that book, I bring to bear the core tenets of Bourdieu's sociology to bear on a wide area of data. I use field data, observations that I carried out, first-hand observation in the ghetto of Chicago and in the urban periphery of Paris. I use historical data, I use survey data, and I compare the structure and the experience of urban marginality in the inner core of Chicago, where the historic black ghetto is located, and in the outer periphery of Paris, where the traditional working class neighborhoods who are being transformed supposedly into immigrant ghettos are located. And I provide essentially three theses, and I'm going to summarize these three theses and tie them to the argument I just made about Gezi Park. First thesis, I try to understand the particular reconfiguration, the transformation of the black American ghetto after the 1960s. The 1960s was, as you know, a movement of, there was a civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, of Malcolm X, of Black Power, of that essentially tore down the historic regime of racial domination inherited from the era of slavery. And that, in a sense, 30 years, 40 years later, allowed for the election of Obama. So we must understand what happened to the ghetto after the success of the civil rights movement. Why must we do this? Because the term ghetto has been used, and the imagery coming from America has been used all around the world to describe conditions of urban decline, conflict, desolation, and destitution. The trope of the ghetto has circulated internationally and is used everywhere around the world to describe a neighborhood that goes bad, a neighborhood where the housing goes down, where crime becomes prevalent, where people deal drugs, where the authorities cannot assert themselves. It's typically characterized or believed to be going in the direction of the ghetto. So first I provide a diagnosis, and I show that in fact this is a wrong vision. What happened isn't that the ghetto deteriorated and became a space of violence, of dread, of dissolution, and that the ghetto is a place of violence, dread, and dissolution. Rather, I show that the ghetto collapsed and disappeared. The reason why violence, fear, destitution, degradation became characteristic of the inner city of the United States is not because it was ghettoized, it's because the ghetto collapsed. The ghetto collapsed and was replaced by a different socio-spatial formation. But for that, in order to arrive at this diagnosis, you must understand what a ghetto is. And you must use the term rigorously. And to do that, it's a paradox. You first have to construct a robust sociological concept of the ghetto, because social scientists have used the term ghetto very widely, but they have never used it very rigorously. They've used it to describe whatever people in the day and age call a ghetto. So what I do, I return to history, and I went back to the origins of the term in 16th century Italy, where the first ghetto in Venice was invented, and I compare the Jewish ghetto of Venice in Renaissance Europe to the black American ghetto of Chicago from the 1920s to the 60s, and I take a third case, which is the Burakumin ghetto. The Burakumin are an outcast category in Japan that has been similarly corralled and contained in space. And I show that a ghetto is not a place of disintegration. It's not a place of segregation. It's not a place of poverty. It's not a place of violence. It's not a place of stigma. A ghetto is a form of integration. It's a spatial device that is used to bring a stigmatized population into the city, to allow for that population to come into the city so that it can be economically exploited, but also that will allow for that population to be separated in the city, to have its own parallel city within the city. So Jews are brought into Venice or Rome or Prague because the rulers of the city need Jews to gain access to long-distance trade, to trade in luxury goods, to trade in military goods, access to medicine, medical knowledge, for which Jews, being historically a trading diaspora, had all of these forms of economic and cultural capital. See? So the political capital, the ruler of the city, wanted to acquire these riches. So you wanted to have the group, but the group was stigmatized. There was a belief going back all the way to the days of Christ that Jews were dangerous, were responsible for the death of Christ, were polluted and polluting, and that having intimate contact with a Jewish person would expose you to the risk of apostasy. You would give up your religion. And so you wanted to avoid intimate contact with Jews. So you needed Jews inside the city to acquire the forms of capital they would bring, but you wanted to keep them at a distance. The ghetto is a device that allows you to bring them into the city and to give them their own space, where you assign Jews to a particular neighborhood and you assign the neighborhood to Jews. So only Jews will live in this neighborhood and they will be separated in their daily encounter. So then we can characterize it. And so now zoom to the history of the United States. What happens to blacks when they come into the northern industrial cities? For the same reason. Why are they brought into the cities? Because you need their labor power for the factories of the booming industries of the 40s era. You need black labor. But there is similarly the belief blacks are stigmatized by the heritage of slavery. There's a belief that they are congenitally inferior. You don't want to mix. You don't want to have intimate contact with blacks. So how are you going to have blacks inside the white city and yet keep them at a distance? Put them in the ghetto, the black city within the white, just like you have the Jewish city inside the Christian. So there we see what are the four building blocks of a ghetto. The four building blocks of a ghetto are a stigma. You have a stigmatized population. Constraints. You force that population to reside in a special district. Third element, spatial containment. Stigma, constraint, spatial confinement, but as you confine that population, you give it its own neighborhood, its own space, its own separate city. You give it a protected arena where it will develop its own parallel institutions. So the fourth element of ghettoization is institutional parallelism. And so we see that when a population will be ghettoized, it will acquire new institutions. It will be in a relationship of subordination, a vertical relationship of subordination. Christians dominate Jews and exclude them. But the relationship, the vertical dimension of domination, will lead to a horizontal dimension of institutional flowering and of the experience of reciprocity and dignity in the protected space of the ghetto. Jews will encounter other Jews and will be able to engage in relationships of equality, mutual respect, and reciprocity in the protected gates inside of the walls of the ghetto. Blacks will be able to experience reciprocity, dignity, social horizontality inside of the black ghetto. Here we see the four building blocks of the ghetto: stigma, constraint, spatial confinement, institutional parallelism. The two functions of the ghetto extract economic value of the group, but also ostracize that group. But we see four elements of the structures, two functions, but we also see the duality, the Janus-faced reality of the ghetto, that it is both a sword, an instrument of domination, the vertical dimension, but it is also a shield, the horizontal dimension of reciprocity, of dignity. Reciprocity, dignity, having a protected space, allows the ghettoized group to build its own economic, social, and cultural capital, and eventually to challenge the stigma. And so here now we know what the ghetto is, and therefore we can understand what happened to the ghetto after the 1960s. It collapsed. It collapsed, why? Because it no longer fulfills, for three reasons. It no longer fulfills a function of economic extraction. Why? Because the American economy has moved from industry to services, and the industrial jobs are no longer in the city. They are outside, they are in the South, they are in the global South. And so you no longer need the unskilled black labor in the central city. So now we have essentially a ghetto that loses its function of economic extraction and only operates as an instrument of social ostracization. And so what happens, that's the first reason. The second reason is the great black migration into the city creates the great white migration to the suburbs. And as whites migrate to the suburbs, they transport the center of political gravity of the country from the city to the suburbs, which means that the political force of blacks in the cities is diminished. And of course, the third element that led to the end of the ghetto is the protest of blacks themselves. The civil rights movement is the refusal to be contained, separated in the separate black city within the white. And so we see in the 60s the ghetto collapses. It ends. There is no longer a ghetto. There is a segregated neighborhood. There are neighborhood that becomes poor, yes, but that's no longer a ghetto. What is replaced? It's replaced by a dual structure, what I call the hyper-ghetto, essentially a ghetto that has lost its horizontal dimension. It's only an instrument of ostracization. It's a territory of poverty, of dissolution, of dread, of crime. Yes, that's not the ghetto. That's the hyper-ghetto. And the other element of that dual structure is the black segregated middle-class districts that emerge. After the 60s, there's also the growth of the black bourgeoisie. The black bourgeoisie doesn't grow into the ghetto. It grows in segregated black middle-class neighborhoods where it's separated from both from whites, but also from the black lower class. And so we see this change in structure, and I argue that this change in structure is related to the changing policies of the state. And that's something I didn't expect when I started this inquiry. I realized that you can't work simply with an equation with race and class. It's not an end space. The relationship of race and class in space is economically underdetermined and politically overdetermined by the changing policies of the state, essentially that moves from supporting cities to supporting the poor in cities to essentially making cities sites of competition for the accumulation of cultural and economic capital. And therefore, the state now devalues those who don't have capital and no longer supports public housing, no longer supports infrastructure, but supports projects to attract businesses, to attract wealthy families, because wealthy families are more quiet, they pose fewer problems, and they pay taxes, and they consume, and this makes the city wealthier. So we see a change in orientation in state policies that will determine the shift from the ghetto to the hyper-ghetto, and the extraordinary concentration of poverty, dread, dissolution, violence in the black hyper-ghetto, which is, in a sense, a different urban animal than the ghetto. That's essentially thesis number one, is having clarified the evolution of urban marginality in America, then I can turn to the comparison between Western Europe and the United States. In Western Europe, in the last two decades, there's been a moral panic about traditional working class neighborhoods are turning into ghettos. And you hear that in the media, in journalism, in policy and political debate, and even in some sectors of the academy, where scholars will produce research where they say, oh, this neighborhood has become a ghetto. And you ask them, what do you mean by ghetto? Oh, I mean a space of violence, a space of destitution, a space of poverty, to which I say, but the Jewish ghetto of Venice, when it arose, was a place for the accumulation of wealth, of organizations, of dignity. It was actually a magnet. The ghetto wasn't a foil. It wasn't a space that people wanted to avoid. The Jewish ghetto of Venice attracted Jewish intellectuals from all over Europe who wanted to come and live in the Jewish ghetto because it was also a center of cultural production. The first Jewish books were printed in Venice. The elaboration of religious theories and so on and so forth were elaborated in the ghetto. In fact, the Jewish identity was a product of ghettoization. The various strands of the Jewish diaspora, which were differentiated by nationality, by region, and by religious tradition, came to be united and forged a shared Jewish identity when they were ghettoized. So the ghetto was a space of organization. It was a space of, there's an interesting distinction introduced by a British sociologist named David Lockwood, and I apologize for introducing a somewhat turgid analytic concept, but it's a very important one. He says there's a difference between structural integration. Structural integration makes reference to how the different parts of a social system hold together. It's the structure. How is the structure held together? Structural integration and social integration. Social integration is how do different populations get together. The ghetto is an instrument of structural integration. Without social integration, you bring Jews into the city, they have a place in the city, they have a role. They are one of the key elements of the functioning of the city. They are integrated in the city structurally, but they are not integrated socially in terms of the individual face-to-face relationship. They remain separated, they don't intermarry, but intermarriage is a good indicator. Similarly, blacks are structurally integrated into the Fordist city, but it's structural integration without social integration, because they don't intermarry, they don't meet, they have their own separate space, they remain socially ostracized. So we can, now if we understand the ghetto as a means of integration, structural integration, some without social integration, then we can understand that the ghetto is also, for the subordinate group, the vector of paradoxical advantages. This is what I call the paradoxical benefits of ghettoization. If a group is ghettoized, it's able to develop its own sphere of life, its own organization, its own political strength, its own identity, and eventually it will be able to challenge the stigma to which it is subordinate. If a group is not ghettoized, then it will not have the paradoxical benefits of ghettoization. Now we turn to Western Europe, and I ask, the dominant discourse has been that the urban periphery of Western Europe has become ghettoized. And what people mean by that, when they use that, it's a folk notion. They mean it's become segregated, it's become poor, it's become violent, it's become the neighborhoods where you don't want to go. That's a stigma attached to a territory, but that doesn't correspond at all to ghettoization. In fact, these territories are pauperized, impoverished, stigmatized territories that are moving away from the pattern of the ghetto. And I'll briefly outline this argument. This is why I call them, paradoxically, anti-ghettos. I call them anti-ghettos because they are moving away from that pattern. Why are they moving away from that pattern? Is that an area, if an area is ghettoized or a population is becoming ghettoized, what should we observe? We should observe that the population is becoming more and more ethnically homogeneous because the territory is being reserved for a particular group. What do we observe throughout the urban periphery of Western France or Western England or Germany or Italy or the Netherlands is that these neighborhoods are becoming more and more ethnically heterogeneous, not ethnically homogeneous. If these neighborhoods are turning into ghettos, it means that more and more of the members of a particular group are corralled in this particular area. What do we observe throughout Western Europe? That post-colonial migrants, including Turks, in the cities of Western Europe, are more and more dispersed. Yes, there are areas of concentration where they are more visible, but overall they are more dispersed over the national territory than they were earlier. So we are moving away from the pattern of the ghetto. Third element, if the population is ghettoized, we will see that as it's given its own territory, it will build more and more of its own organization. So we will see a process of organizational density will rising. What do we observe in the urban periphery of Western Europe? We observe, on the contrary, that institutions are dying, that organizations are withering away. We are seeing a decline in organizational density. If an area is being ghettoized, what shall we see also? We shall see the production of a unified cultural identity. What do we observe in this urban periphery? The failure to produce a shared collective identity for the populations that are relegated in these territories. And lastly, if a population in an area is turning into a ghetto, the boundaries of that neighborhood should become increasingly impassable because you are a member, you are assigned to that territory. What do we see in these areas? We observe that, in fact, people are highly mobile. People are more mobile in these neighborhoods than in the average household. In France, it's very striking that the people who lived in the 571 officially designated sensitive neighborhood, 6 in 10 families will leave these neighborhoods in the course of 10 years. This is 20% more mobility than the average French household. So what we are seeing in all five of these fronts, ethnic homogeneity, ethnic concentration, organizational density, the capacity to create an ethnic collective, a collective identity, and the porousness of the boundary, we see that these neighbors are moving away from the pattern of the ghetto. And so if we want to diagnose them well, we have to understand that they are actually moving away from the pattern of the ghetto. The ghetto is a wrong diagnosis. What these territories suffer from is the same thing as what the hyper-ghetto now suffers from, is two forces. The material force of the fragmentation of wage labor, the fact that these are urban populations deprived of economic and cultural capital, for whom now the normal horizon of work is not the stable wage work of the Fordist Keynesian era, of can't drive by the formula 40, 50, 60. You work 40 hours a week at a factory job for 50 weeks of the year with 2 weeks vacation until you're 60. And that's the anchor of your life. That's the stability. That's how you can project yourself in the future, construct a household, and reproduce yourself across time. Now this formula is dead. With the fragmentation of wage labor, we see this formula hasn't been replaced by any formula, because now we see the rise of part-time, insecure, short-term, the Mac jobs, the so-called Mac jobs. That's the number one force that is creating this insecurity, and that is in a sense normalized social insecurity as one of the constitutive property of the post-industrial proletariat. Is wage labor used to be a vector of stability and solidarity with others. Now it becomes a vector of instability, insecurity, and separation from others, because others are entering into also their own formula, no longer the same formula to create. And then second, and I'll close with that, the very important element of what I talked about, this discourse of ghettoization has participated into the stigmatization of the residents of these neighborhoods. And look in Turkey, the parallel has been the shift from talking about gecekondus to varosh. The neighborhoods where nobody would want to live. The neighborhoods are only the rejects of society who tolerate living. The denigration, the stigma attached to a place creates a sense of indignity to the residents. This sense of indignity translates to not only the strategies of the residents, who seek to disidentify from one another, who try to find a single private solution to the problem that they face. In particular, they retreat into the private sphere, they seek to exit the neighborhood, they refuse to associate with others. This creates atomism and social disintegration. This creates a proletariat that becomes like the proverbial bag of potatoes. Marx famously, in his essay on the class wars in France, described the peasantry as a bag of potatoes, because, you know, well, there's no link between them, because the isolated communities, the urban poor of today, are fragmented and are atomized, both by the force of fragmented wage labor, but also by the discourse of denigration of space, by territorial stigmatization that makes them urban pariahs. So now I come to my conclusion, which is, how does that relate to social justice? And when we come to the question of social justice, we have many traditions. I'm going to skip a development that I don't have the time to cover, but I'll rely on two approaches. The work of Michael Sandel, an American philosopher, who talks about in his book, Justice, What is the Right Thing to Do? He proposes that there are three alternate models of justice, three bases on which we can distribute goods. You can decide that you need to maximize welfare, that's utilitarianism, but this, you can respect freedom and individual rights, that's the second condition of justice, or you can cultivate virtue, that's a third criterion. But I would add a fourth element that I take from, in particular, the work of Axel Ernest and Nancy Fraser, is that you must also be able to acquire dignity. And what I would argue is these two forces of the fragmentation of wage labor and the spatial territorial, spatial stigma, as they converge and as they hit the same marginalized urban population in their varosh, in their problem quartier of Germany, in their quartier sensible of France, in their quartieri degradati of Italy, in their sink estates of England. It's a revealing thing that every country now has a name to describe these areas. This is a new phenomenon. Every country has now an expression to describe those areas that are the place of dread and dissolution and violence and vice, where this, everything comes apart. These populations, these places, all of these four conditions of justice are violated. The welfare of this population is violated because of the material degradation. The respect of the freedom is violated because the way to contain this urban marginality has been to roll out punitive policies, and especially aggressive policies of using the police, the courts, and the prison system to contain the disorders that are now brewing in these neighborhoods, creating the conditions under which you can then use your police, your courts, and your prison system to resist the protest of the cultural bourgeoisie in Gezi Park. If you normalize the use of the penal states to manage poverty, it legitimizes the use, it facilitates the use of the police to also criminalize protests around urban parks. And these, of course, these neighborhoods violate the third condition of the cultivation of virtue, and they violate the fourth condition, the respect and the granting of dignity. So on all four counts, the current regime of urban marginality is deeply unjust. It fails to meet any of these four major criteria by which an urban society may be deemed just, and therefore it means that we must reorient our analysis. So social justice then in the city has these very, and I'll close with that. If you go home with only one idea, I'll say this is the one idea. Social justice in the city has two dimensions that we must always hold together. There's in analysis and in action and in policy recommendations. There's a class, there's a material dimension. You are poor, you are marginalized. This is my wage labor, this is the class fragmentation element. But there's also a status dimension, having dignity, having honor, being a member of the civic compact. And the second symbolic dimension, and this is what is covered by the notion of territorial civitatis, is just as important. And when we think about fighting for social justice in the city, as I think the people in Gezi Park protest sought to do, we must remember to extend the reach of our action, not only to the holders of cultural capital, but to those who hold no capital, to the urban outcast. And when we promote action to have a fully inclusive city in which, in spite of inequality, we'll have a modicum of justice, we must always be clear to hold together these two dimensions. We must fight marginality not only in its material dimension of poverty, but also in its symbolic dimension, and give every urban citizen dignity. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bakan, and I would like to invite Raquel Pink to present with a play.
Bu kadar güzel tanımlardan, güzel açıklamalardan sonra sistemlerin ve devletlerin ve toplumların birbirlerine yaptıklarını, bu kadar güzel açıklamalardan sonra benim söyleyeceğim var mı ifade edeceğim? Öncelikle çok teşekkür ediyorum tabii ki Boğaziçi'nin bu güzel çalışmaları için. Gerçekten çok minnettarız. İnsanlık onuru minnettar aslında. Sağ olun. Bizler her ne için mücadele edersek edelim, mücadele verirsek verelim, ifade özgürlüğü için olsun, başka şeyler, yaşam hakkı için, ağaç için, yalana karşı olsun, ne için mücadele edersek edelim, önemli olan doğruluğu ve adaleti en üstte tutmaktır aslında. Şimdi biz bu ülkemizde çok şey gördük. Onu yani dayanamıyorum, söylemek istiyorum. Maalesef Allah'ın adını kullanarak cinayet de işliyorlar, hırsızlık da yapıyorlar, soysuzluk da yapıyorlar. Tüm insanlar için, belli bir kesim için söylemiyorum. Bunları yaparken aslında Tanrı'yı bu durumlarda kendilerine benzetmiş oluyorlar. Yani haşa haşa Tanrı'yı hırsız yapmış oluyorlar. Tanrı'yı katil yapmış oluyorlar. Farkında değiller mi, farkındalar mı artık kendileri bilirler. Yüreğim bunun için çok üzülüyor gerçekten. Boşuna Tanrı'nın sözü demiyor, dudaklarıyla bu halk beni anıyor fakat yürekleri benden uzaktır diyor. Evdenden, onurdan, özgürlükten bahsettiği, çok sağ olun, var olun. Pavlus eskiden saydığı onuru gerçekten sonra tanıdığı gerçek doğruluk için süprüntü sayıyorum dedi. Yani gerçeğe ulaşabilirsek, bizim önce ölüme dair razı olduğumuz bir sürü şeylerin süprüntü olduğunu anlayabiliyoruz. Tanrı hepimizin yüreğine gerçeği ulaştırsın diyeyim. Teşekkür ederim.
To a small reception we have at Kennedy Lodge, and thank you all for coming and being part of this event. Thank you.